This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, April 5, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Condoleezza Rice is on Capitol Hill trying to convince Congress to allow the nuclear deal with India. African heads of state are pushing for a peace agreement in Sudan's Darfur region. And we'll hear from Baghdad on why Iraqis are buying guns in record numbers. We'll bring you these stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Amnesty International released a report today on CIA rendition flights. The human rights organization is calling for an independent public inquiry into possible British involvement. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
While Amnesty International says any illegal activity is by nature difficult to track, their report released today has logged more than 200 suspected CIA flights passing through British airports alone. For the first time, their report shows evidence of how nearly 1,000 suspected CIA flights have taken place worldwide. Senior advisor to Amnesty International, Anne Fitzgerald.
The CIA is sometimes creating fictional front companies that allow them to use their planes. So they have a company called, for instance, Premier Executive Transport, which only has two planes, both of which seem to be used exclusively for CIA business. The company's now disappeared. One of the planes has been sold off. The other one's been transferred to another company, which also has no address, no premises, no effective operation. So that's one way that the CIA runs these planes. The other way seems to be to lease them directly from legitimate commercial transport companies. And these are companies that need to find out what their planes are being used for.
Amnesty International's report also includes testimony from three men describing their rendition. They were held for more than a year in a location unknown to them. After cross-referencing evidence, Amnesty International believes the likely location of the prison was in Eastern Europe. Foreign Secretary Jack Straw has said there's no evidence the Bush administration had asked to render detainees through British airports. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
The Senate Appropriations Committee passed a massive emergency supplemental spending package yesterday. The majority of the nearly $107 billion package will go to fund the ongoing occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, but includes money slated for disaster relief at home and abroad, as well as funding for an assortment of other interests. The day after Massachusetts passed a bill requiring health care coverage for almost all of the state's residents, President Bush visited neighboring Connecticut to promote his proposal for health savings accounts. FSRN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
Connecticut is the wealthiest state in the nation, but has more uninsured residents than many other states. About 200 people came to Bridgeport today to protest Bush's speaking engagement. They came for many reasons, chiefly to oppose the war and to call for universal health coverage. Brian Petronella, president of Local 371 of the United Food and Commercial Workers, said universal health care is an urgent need.
When we go to negotiations, we represent folks at Stop and Shop and Shaw's. They say to us, why should we provide health care for our workers when Walmart's not providing health care for like 800,000 of their workers? So yes, it becomes a problem for us in negotiations.
Although protesters were kept a block away from the speaking event, they were able to express their sentiments as Bush's motorcade passed. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
An indefinite fast by an anti-dam activist in India has entered its eighth day. Binu Alex has the story.
The anti-dam activist Medha Patkar's condition worsened today as her fast entered its eighth day, and doctors have warned that the next 48 hours will be very critical for her. She is demanding a halt to the construction of the Narmada Dam project. With a height of 122 meters, the proposed dam on the Narmada River in Gujarat will be one of the largest in India. The project will displace an estimated 320,000 people, mostly members of indigenous tribes with no political or social base. The government says the dam is a lifeline for water-starved people in western and central India, where drought is a common feature. According to World Commission on Dams, India's 4,300 dams have submerged about 37,500 square kilometers and have displaced at least 42 million people. From Ahmedabad in India, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
In Mexico, hundreds of small farmers yesterday occupied and shut down the pumping station that supplies running water to approximately 80% of Acapulco. They were protesting the construction of the proposed La Parota hydroelectric dam in the region. Argentina's lower house of Congress will vote on officially turning water utility operations over to a state-run company. The French water services company, Suez, is seeking legal action against the government. Marie Trigona has more from Buenos Aires.
The national government added a decree to the bill to be voted on today that would make it impossible to reprivatize water services. The new ICE, a state-run company, took over water utility operations in Buenos Aires and surrounding suburbs last week on an interim basis. The French water company Suez handed over operations without protest, but is seeking a $1.7 billion indemnity through the World Bank International Court. Argentina's president, Néstor Kirchner, who supports the ISA bill, has said that the government has no obligation to buy back the company Suez operated that managed water services. The government has delegated over $50 million to help start up the state-run company. The government canceled Suez's water utility concessions last month, citing underperformance. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Chagona in Buenos Aires.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice spent the day on Capitol Hill, urging Congress to allow the nuclear deal with India to proceed. Rice says the program is important for India's energy needs and for the U.S. economy, but senators are indicating concern on a number of issues, including an attempt by the administration to sidestep Congress. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell has more.
The Bush administration is asking Congress to change the law to amend the Atomic Energy Act of 1954 in order for the U.S. to trade nuclear material with India so they can increase their nuclear energy program. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice testified before both houses of Congress about the proposal, which she says will open doors for the U.S. into the expanding Indian economy.
We believe that this initiative will unlock the progress of our expanding relationship in other areas.
She also says that energy is the biggest threat to national security, and unless India, soon to be the most populated country with one of the largest economies, will double its energy needs by 2025. She also says that if India has access to nuclear power, they won't have to rely upon an unstable Iran to provide them with oil. But senators have problems with the legislation suggested by the administration because it would remove Congress from its oversight role. Republican Senator Lincoln Chafee from Rhode Island questioned Secretary Rice.
Most of these amendments give more power to the president and take away congressional oversight.
Well, the amendment to the Atomic Energy Act, we believe is necessary so that we can have a reliable and predictable nuclear commercial trade with India. The Congress, of course, and the Congress has up front, and that's why we're coming to you now, the ability to assess the deal, to look at its upsides and downsides, and then to affirm in a vote yes or no to amend the legislation that you wish to do so.
In order for the deal to be enacted, India must comply with safeguards agreed upon by the U.S. and the International Atomic Energy Agency. But no nuclear standards for India are yet in place. Democratic Senator Paul Sarbanes from Maryland expressed deep concern about that.
You want us to pass it not knowing what the safeguards are?
Well, Senator, we would like to have the legislation passed. We think that the timing,
well,
the
sequence... Well, I understand that, but we're trying to get a full picture here and do a proper evaluation.
We do think that the safeguards negotiation could take some time. Those safeguards will be clear to everyone at the time that they're undertaken. And again, nothing in this legislation can take effect until the president determines that there is an acceptable agreement with the IAEA.
Well, I understand that, but that's the president's determination, not a congressional determination as to the adequacy of the safeguards. Is that correct?
Well, Senator, it is a presidential determination as to the safeguards.
President Bush all but sealed a trade deal between the two countries during a trip in early March of this year. India has tested nuclear weapons and has never signed on to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. That treaty attempts to restrict the spread of nuclear weapons while making available nuclear energy technology. Senators and other critics say this could send the wrong message to Iran, who continues to enrich uranium despite objection from the international community. Critics also say this could open the doors for India to increase its nuclear weapons capability and possibly start an arms war in the region. Democratic Senator Joseph Biden from Delaware.
This is a big deal. No pun intended. This is a big deal. And I think if we cut through it all, it comes down to a simple bet we're making. And it's a bet.
Secretary Rice says other nuclear states, France, Great Britain, and Russia, have expressed their support for the deal, but China has reservations. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Since the bombing of the Shiite Askariya Shrine in Samarra, which resulted in Shiite militias attacking Sunni mosques in Baghdad, Iraqis have been buying guns in record numbers. FSRN's David Enders reports from Baghdad, where local militias continue to arm themselves in preparation for further fighting.
One of the causes of sectarian violence is the continuing displacement of Shiites from villages in central Iraq. In Imam al-Ridha, a neighborhood on Baghdad's north side that has become home to displaced Shiites from Taji, north of the capital, the men express an allegiance to cleric Muqtada al-Sadr's Jaish al-Mahdi militia and say they are waiting to fight Sunnis in Baghdad, though al-Sadr at present has called for calm. Nayyam Hussein left Taji after three of his cousins were killed.
I am Jaish al-Imam. If Sayyid Muqtada and our leaders say it's okay to fight, I will fight.
Nader Yassin Mahmoud is a Sunnah Imam at Rashid Drag Mosque on Baghdad's west side. Two of his friends, Imams at other Sunnah mosques, have been killed and others have been attacked. He is making plans to leave to Dubai as soon as possible. The cooperation between Sunnah guerrillas and the Jaish al-Mahdi that existed in 2004 has fully disintegrated. He says that in the chaos, one group of militia fighters might try to protect Sunnahs while another will attack them. He relates the story of an imam he knew in Zafrania, a neighborhood on Baghdad's west side, who was warned by one group of Mahdi and attacked by another.
Some of them came to him, told him, please run away. He told him, please, imam, run away from this mosque. He told him, why? He said, I don't want to tell you something. Please, I like you. I don't want to hurt you. I don't want to hurt your family. Please take your bags and run away from mosque. This imam take the bags and take everything. Then after 2 days, they came and to the mosque, you know, by.
The Jaish al-Mahdi battled U.S. troops throughout 2004 and carried out retributive attacks following the Askariya mosque bombing. Nader says that the specter of future attacks has caused the men in his neighborhood, which is middle class and largely Sunnah, to arm themselves, and that the Iraqi Islamic Party, one of the country's most popular Sunnah parties, has encouraged clerics to carry guns.
All the people ready to defend their mosque or their home, you know, or their child or their man or woman. It is really dangerous because any time in any place, maybe we will see a battle between the militia and the people in that place or there or other place.
Each morning, bodies are found on Baghdad's streets, the victims of sectarian assassinations. In Sadr City, the Shiite neighborhood in North Baghdad that makes up al-Sadr's power base and which the Jaish al-Mahdi essentially controls, Abu Ali al-Tamimi, a Jaish al-Mahdi commander, does not deny elements of the militia are carrying out sectarian reprisals. Young, unemployed men are notoriously hard to control. Just as Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, Iraq's ranking Shiite cleric, could not immediately convince the Jaish al-Mahdi to end the fighting in Najaf and Baghdad against the U.S. military in 2004, killings of Sunnis in Sadr's name seem to be taking place regardless of whether he approves, Tamimi says.
We've had to remove many people from the Jaish al-Mahdi. They're fighting for their sect. They don't care about Muqtada al-Sadr.
But Sadr's own language has created a serious gray area, perhaps intentionally. He has approved killing of Takfiris, Sunni extremists who consider Shiites heretics, and Baathis. When talking to members of the Jaish al-Mahdi, it becomes clear Sunnah members of the government fall into these categories. Salah Mutluq was a member of the Ba'ath Party, Tamimi says of one of the most prominent Sunnah politicians in the government. He also criticizes the Iraqi Islamic Party for not condemning attacks on Shiites. Tamimi says the militia continues to stockpile weapons.
The situation in Iraq is very bad, and we are ready to fight. At any time, there might be fighting between Sunnis and Shiites. Saddam Hussein had weapons factories in Abu Ghraib, Fallujah, and Ramadi. If the Americans go out, the Sunnis have these weapons. We need to have weapons.
As another indicator of the manner in which Iraqis are arming themselves, prices for weapons have more than doubled since the bombing of the Askariya Mosque in February. In Baghdad, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
African heads of state will push the warring parties from Sudan's Darfur region to clinch a peace agreement at a meeting on April 8 that all sides said on Tuesday could help break the deadlock. Congo Republic's President Denis Sassou Nguesso, current chairman of the African Union, Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo, and AU Commission Chairman Alpha Omar Konate are due to take part in Saturday's meeting in the Nigerian capital. Meanwhile, more voices are calling for an end to the deadlock between Arab leaders and the UN over the issue. FSRN's Ola Farawati has more.
Images of slaughtered children, a man lying face down on the African desert after being sexually assaulted, and a group of Sudanese men missing their eyes and ears are what new satellite channels are broadcasting about Sudan's troubled Darfur region. This, as Arab leaders agreed in a summit last week to allocate an aid package of some $150 million to help fund the cash-strapped African Union troops deployed in the region, which witnessed the death of more than 400,000 people and the displacement of more than 2 million. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak.
We do not want international forces in Darfur. We want the problem to be solved within the Arab context. Having international forces is not entirely safe.
The Arab leaders, in a rare instance, are supporting the Sudanese leadership against a United Nations proposal to prepare for the deployment of as many as 20,000 peacekeepers in Darfur to take over from 7,000 African Union soldiers. The UN calls Darfur the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, while the US has accused the Sudanese government of committing genocide in the region. Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir is wary of UN military intervention in Darfur, but Sudanese political analyst Hassan Najila says the situation is worsening in the conflict. It began in February 2003 when black African tribes rose up against the government, saying they had been marginalized. The government responded by backing Arab Janjaweed militias, who brutally crushed the rebellion, analyst Najila.
What is happening in Darfur is something strange. What is happening is a big conspiracy, and that is why the media coverage of the situation is very little. The African Union troops are not able to contain the situation, which is turning into genocide.
Sudanese opposition politicians said the government is scared UN forces in Darfur may be used to arrest anyone indicted by the International Criminal Court, which is investigating alleged war crimes in the region. Jordanian political analyst Mohammed Abu Rumman said Egypt and Saudi Arabia are worried that an international intervention might mean the deployment of foreign forces near their borders, threatening their sovereignty. That, he says, explains the unprecedented Arab support for African Union forces. But he added that the UN should take a stiffer stance against the Arab rejection of international forces.
I believe that eventually the UN and the international community will stand against the Arab stance. I can see an international willingness to contain the worsening humanitarian situation in Darfur, especially since the situations there are bigger than some political concerns.
In Amman, Jordan, this is Ola Farawati reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Relations between the media and the government have been very tense in Thailand since the beginning of Prime Minister Thaksin's administration in 2001. FSRN's Severine Bardon reports from Bangkok, where the media is fighting back to defend press freedoms now that the Prime Minister is due to step down.
Yeah. Today was a day of mobilization for Thailand's media. Representatives of the main news organizations gathered at the Thai Journalist Association to express their grievances against Thaksin's administration. United under the slogan No to Press Harassment, hundreds of journalists demonstrated in a cheerful atmosphere. The press played an important role in the political crisis that eventually led to the resignation of Thailand's prime minister. Their critical articles and editorials infuriated the government more than once, and several newspapers and journalists are still facing legal charges. They are accused of defamation by the government or by Thaksin himself. The prime minister pressured the media since he came into power in 2001. Sunay Pasuk, Thailand's representative for Human Rights Watch, details one of the methods used by the government to control the media.
They wanted to break free from Thaksin's control, but they couldn't because the government used political pressure, but more important, financial pressure to control the print media. The advertising is so important for their survival. After the financial crisis in 1997, the Shin Corp's empire, their alliance, have become the most important source for advertising budget. And that have been cleverly used to put print media under control simply by denying the access to advertising budget or withdrawing those advertisements.
Other means were used against outspoken journalists. Tep Chai Yong used to work with ITV, a channel that, when created, was the most independent one in the country. He resigned when ITV was bought by Shin Corp, a telecommunication empire owned by the Prime Minister's family. After joining the Nation Multimedia Group, one of the most openly anti-Thaksin news organizations, he began to feel the pressure.
The first 2 years of Thaksin administration, the harassments of the media were very, very open. For example, myself and many of my colleagues in the profession were subject to investigation by this so-called anti-money laundering office, which accused us of laundering money. So, of course, we didn't do anything wrong, but that was an obvious attempt at harassing the media.
Now that Thaksin is due to step down, media organizations are hopeful that their situation is going to improve, as explains Pongsak Payakvichen, former president of Thailand's Press Council.
I don't think all the governments or the parliaments or the politicians are bad or try to against press freedom, no. Because only Thaksin, because you know, Thaksin called himself the CEO, and he thinks the government is his company, and he thinks that the whole nation is the company of the Chinawat. That's why he come out like this.
The tension between press and government had reached such levels last week that a mob besieged the office of the Komchatluk, an anti-Thaksin newspaper, and eventually managed to suspend its publication. Again, the administrative court will have to deal with this matter since several complaints have been filed by all parties following this rather violent demonstration. In the meantime, journalists are counting on the support of their readers gathered today in front of the Journalist Association.
I want to say, Komchatluk, you fighting for the people. You are the new paper in my heart.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Séverine Bardon in Bangkok.
Dozens of New Orleans public housing development residents forced their way past police to visit their homes on Tuesday. 7 months after the storms, the vast majority of public housing residents have not been able to return and are beginning to organize to pressure the housing authority to let them come back. FSRN's Christian Roseland is in New Orleans and files this report.
At least two dozen residents forced their way past Housing Authority of New Orleans security and New Orleans police to enter the St. Bernard development on Tuesday. The development is surrounded by a chain-link fence topped with barbed wire, which many residents say is to keep them from returning. Adonis Exposé of the Housing Authority of New Orleans, or HANO, says that 867 families have been allowed to return to units in public housing developments, more than 5,000 of which were occupied last August. Exposé says that the Housing Authority has been focusing on repairing the units that were not damaged by the flood, but that answer is inadequate for many who wonder why 7 months later no repairs have been made to developments like St. Bernard. Pamela Mahogany lived in St. Bernard before the storm and works as a nurse practitioner. She says part of the reason why fixing public housing has been such a low priority is a negative public image.
You know, I know people say it was crime written. It had so much crime. It had so much drugs. It had this, it had that, all the negative. But they had families that had close-knit, that had bonds, that went to work, that raised their kids, that took their kids to school.
Exposé of the Housing Authority points out that St. Bernard was extensively damaged by flooding, and that the agency cannot allow residents to put themselves in danger by cleaning out their units, a demand of organizers. However, Mahogany and other residents say that the development was in bad shape long before the storm.
A lot of the conditions that the units are in now, they were in when we were living in them. The whole motive to me is just to keep us out.
Stephanie Mingle also lived in St. Bernard and is an organizer of Tuesday's protest. More than 50 residents of St. Bernard arrived, many from Texas and other states. Mingo says that it was a painful reunion and that they want their community back.
I'm happy because I'm in New Orleans and this is where I want to be, but I also want my people. I want to sit on the porch and say good morning, Miss Johnson. Good evening, Miss Adams. You need something from the store? You need me to help you? I like to see that. Kids playing in a courtyard.
Agency spokesperson Exposé would not say how many residents, like Mingo and others, are currently awaiting units to reopen. As for Mingo, she says that today was just the beginning.
And I think it's going to grow bigger, bigger, and bigger, because I'm not going to stop until they open it. They can open one section. I'm not going to stop.
For FSRN, I'm Christian Roseland.
I'm tired riding backwards and forwards to Houston, to New Orleans, from New Orleans to Houston.
Dozens of people chose to sleep on sidewalks and parks across the nation on Friday to protest the criminalization of homeless people. The sleepouts were part of a national day of action that took place in more than 30 U.S. cities, from Atlanta, Georgia to Portland, Oregon. FSRN's Rebecca Miles files this report from New York.
One of the participating cities was Fremont, California. Missionary Chris Weaver with the Christian Facilitator Missionary said he was sleeping in the main park with his friends. He thought the chief of police wasn't happy, but argues he's a taxpayer and we the people own it. He said he had noticed more people slipping down into homelessness than previously.
I mean, like after the .com went .bomb, we saw a lot of those people. Now it's starting again. I see a lot of Hispanics, and it's really concerning me because we need to do something about this. And so this is just one more thing that I'm trying, because I go out and try and get grants from the government. Since Bush brought in that faith-based initiative, I've been putting in for grants, trying to get food, because out here in the valley, they tell under food that these people could be eating, and I got to get a building to put it in so I can process it and stuff. So I got a lot of stuff on my table, but this is just one of another thing to try and bring awareness.
In New York City, advocates Picture the Homeless decided to sleep outside one of the many buildings that are warehoused instead of being turned into affordable housing. About 40 people spent Friday night on 43rd Street and 3rd Avenue without incident. William Burnett is the outreach coordinator from Picture the Homeless and says city administration is lying when it comes to building affordable housing and pointing to declining homeless numbers. He says what Mayor Michael Bloomberg is not telling people is...
He also had DHS pressure the shelters into creating what they call long-term stayer programs, where they're actually pushing people onto the street. The long-term stayer program says that if you've been in the shelter for more than 9 months, then you have to be... You have to go into an accelerated program where essentially the city tells you it's your fault, you're still in the system, even though the cost of housing isn't going down and housing's not becoming available. It's still your fault. And so they pressure you into finding a way to get out of the system. If you can't do it, then they put you out of the system and onto the streets for 90 days. And what has resolved that, then DHS is able to come back and say, look, the number of homeless in our shelters are going down. Well, yes, it is going down, but it's not going down because of the mayor's positive plans. It's going down because they're pushing people out.
Advocates in New York City are planning further sleepouts this spring and summer, perhaps one a month. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting from New York.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.